Welcome to the Tell Us Something podcast. I'm your host, Mark Moss, founder and executive director of Tell Us Something. The next Tell Us Something event is October 7th, 2025. The theme is Walk on the Wild Side. You can learn about how to pitch your story and get tickets at tellussomething.org. This week on the podcast,
I asked him if he wanted to open up and he jumped at it. He was thrilled. And that was shocking to me and also terrifying. And I wish that maybe I had been a bit more terrified.
Here I am in a refugee camp in Palestine with four other Americans. And what we're doing is we're witnessing the let up of a curfew. Curfew is something that was happening then and is still happening now, where people are not able to leave their home for hours or days at a time.
Four storytellers share their true personal story on the theme, Lost and Found.
I take position on the left side of the doorway. My partner fills in the position of the right side of the doorway, and we fill this space. Naturally, our guns are drawn because we're searching this residence, and I yell, "Sir!"
On the sixth day, I got a phone call, and there were three kids on the other line, and they were calling from the Wolf Point pizza joint. I was like, "Hello?" They were like, all they said was, "We found your dog."
Their stories were recorded live in person on June 30th, 2025 at Ogren Park at Allegiance Field in Missoula, Montana, closing out Pride Month. On this episode of the podcast, we're trying out something a little different. Tell Us Something board member Beth Ann Austin generously offered to bring in a professional sound engineer to better capture the feeling of a live event. We're going to try to keep the essence of the live evening by using the storyteller introductions as I introduce the storytellers the night of the event. As usual, I'll give a little teaser of the story before the storyteller shares their story. We'd love to hear from you what you think. Shoot me an email and let me know how you like the new format. You can email me at info@tellussomething.org. Love it? Hate it? Let me know what you think. Thanks. Huge thanks goes out to the Greater Montana Foundation, who encourages communication on issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans. We are so grateful to the Greater Montana Foundation for their support to make the June event possible.
Tell Us Something acknowledges that this land where Ogren Park now stands is the ancestral territory of the Salish and Kalispell peoples who have stewarded it for generations. Summertime is traditionally the prime time for indigenous peoples to gather various berries and roots that are in season. While the bitter roots are already harvested, now is the time for processing and storing any remaining bitter root that have been gathered. Another staple, camas bulbs, are being dug and prepared for storage. Huckleberries, service berries, and choke cherries are ripening and being harvested for immediate consumption and for drying to preserve in winter. We take this moment to honor its land and the native people and the stories that they share with us. To honor them, you can support the ongoing efforts of the Confederated Salish and Kootenai tribes by learning about their cultural initiatives and advocating for indigenous rights. More information can be found at kskt.org.
Tell Us Something stories sometimes have adult themes. Storytellers sometimes use adult language. Please take care of yourselves. From a childhood crush to a series of unexpected turns, Anvada Being shares her story following her lifelong journey of self-discovery and the difficult choices she made along the way. Listen to Anvada as she navigates societal expectations, personal struggles, and ultimately finds her true self amidst unforeseen losses. Anvada calls her story Skittles. Thanks for listening.
Since I was a little girl, I knew that I liked girls. And when I thought to do this, a picture of myself came to my mind at Girl Scout camp. I'm in Pocahontas hiking boots and shorts, a flannel, and a bucket hat. It was pretty cringy, but still one of my favorite things to wear. When I was about seventh grade, I met this girl. She was throwing Skittles at me on the bus, and she became one of the dearest loves of my life. We spent 3 years together having a blast, and early on in that time, when we were about 12, we were at a party at a friend's house. It wasn't really our age party. Her brother was throwing one. And there I met a man, and his name was, not necessary, but for the sake of the story, Brad. So at that party, he gets a camera and he interviews me about my interest in girls. And it was a very inappropriate situation. He was much older than I was, but I didn't understand where that was going to go. About 3 years later, we're 15 years old, Sarah and I, and rascally, we started drinking and really kind of becoming chaotic little messes, really, and hard to control. So this guy appears in my life again, and he offers to, you know, take care of me and wanted me to move in. I thought, I am a nut. I should probably take him up on this, it's going to probably go pretty poorly for me. I moved in with him, and I thought, this is going to be fine. I'm going to have a 1950s-style life, and it's just going to be, you know, beautiful bluebirds and sunshine all the time, and it was nothing like that at all. It was very chaotic, it was violent, and difficult for me to understand from my young perspective. And what was more difficult for me was that I found out over those years that he was not okay with the fact that I liked girls, which was pretty difficult for me, because then I had to accept that I was going to be in this relationship forever without that opportunity to ever have that experience again. My 21st birthday came around, and all I wanted for that was to go to the strip club. And we did. It was great. I drank a ton, got to go up on the stage, and it was a blast. She invited me home. I was thinking that's what was going to happen. And I got down off the stage, and Brad says, we need to go. And I get in the car, and I was still thinking, this is great. And then I found out he did not. He did not think it was as great as I did at all. In fact, he had seen the way I looked at her and realized I would never look at him that way. And so for about a year after that, things got much worse, and I spent all that time trying to convince him that I loved him and thought he was attractive. But now I really wonder whether I was trying to convince myself of that or not. And so look at the divorce. I lost my son in that as well. And I don't go too deeply because that's its whole story in its own. But it broke me. It was hard. I was just barely 21 and I went rampant. I ended up pregnant again. And ironically or not, I had found out 2 weeks after breaking up with the guy, and we broke up because I was making out with a girl at the MMA fights. You know, if I just learned from my lessons. So 2 years go by, I have my daughter, and there's a girl I was very interested in that time, but didn't pursue it, and then I almost dated another woman. But this man came into my life, and my daughter called her dad. And I had not had examples of how to have a female-female relationship in my life. So it didn't even seem possible to be able to introduce that. You know, I went back into this heterosexual relationship with a guy, and I spent about 8 years with him, and because of the effects from the first relationship, he had no idea about my interest in girls. Not at all. We got married, and I felt pretty secure, so one day I thought, you know, I'm gonna have to say something, or or I'm not going to make it. I was losing myself completely. And I did, and I asked him if he wanted to open up, and he jumped at it. He was thrilled. And that was shocking to me and also terrifying. And I wish that maybe I had been a bit more terrified, because I spent about 2 years fielding a lot of text messages asking if it was okay that he had sent pictures to them. It was crazy. And I lost my mind. I was sad. Three kids and a husband, second one, and I didn't have what I was realizing I needed. So 2 years go by and we meet a girl, and about 1 month in, he left me for her, which was not what I was expecting when I opened up the relationship at all. I broke completely after that. Like, I found out I was getting a divorce very suddenly, and I couldn't pull myself together. I didn't expect to lose two relationships. I didn't expect to have kids, like, scattered amongst these different homes. I lost everything that mattered to me. Everything that I thought defined who I was as a good lady. My kids, my husband, my dog, my kid, my things, all of that was gone in all of this. And that is its own long story about how it all got lost. But what I found when I lost everything was that I had covered up everything that allowed me to glow with all of these things that people said I needed to have to be able to be okay. So when I, when I came back here to Missoula after what felt like an odyssey, but was really just a year, I ended up at the Tell Us Something event coming home. And it was very literal for me to come home to Montana, but then also to hear all these stories. It was Pride Month, and I could identify with everything that people were saying. And I spent this last year thinking about it all and thought about everything that I'd applied to myself and questioned whether it did actually apply to me, whether I agreed with the people who'd said it, whether I agreed with the statements. And I didn't. I shed it. And here I am now. And what I found was that once I lost everything, I found myself.
I must apologize to Anvada for mispronouncing her name when I introduced her the night of the show. You will hear me do that here. Anvada, I'm so sorry. Thank you for your grace.
Zavada being. Avada was blessed with a creative Western spirit. She was born in and has lived in Missoula for 35 of her 37 years. She is keenly aware of the vast history of all the lands we walk and is deeply grateful to walk them. She picked magical Missoula as her home after spending a year living off-grid near the Garden of the Gods in Colorado.
In our next story, Gilnar Mansour, a Lebanese-American volunteer in the volatile heart of a Palestinian refugee camp, confronts the harrowing realities of a strict curfew set by the Israeli Defense Forces. Amidst chaos and desperation, she recounts an extraordinary act of quick thinking and unexpected alliance, leading to a moment where vulnerability becomes a powerful tool for survival. Listen to Gilnar share the difficult choices that she made and the blurred lines of impact versus intention in a story that she calls "Who Made Your Breakfast?" Thanks for listening.
refugee camp in Palestine with four other Americans. And what we're doing is we're witnessing the let up of a curfew. Curfew is something that was happening then and is still happening now, where people are not able to leave their home for hours or days at a time. At this point, I think people were on curfew for 11 or 12 days. And so we were watching people running from one direction to the other, trying to exchange goods. There were no new resources, or no new resources in the area often, and at that time, ever. So this would be like someone running to the next village to exchange rice for flour that had not been peed on by the Israeli Defense Force or the IDF. So we have people in different villages, and we're witnessing this chaos. And all we hear next is, Yahayawin, Yahayawin. And the soldiers are screaming, you animals, you animals. They're going to stop the curfew. It's only been a matter of an hour's. So there's been a security breach, and now the soldiers want people to go in to whatever home, a stranger's home. And they're being called animals. So quickly, well, in advance of this trip, we had done some affinity training. This was the Michigan Peace Team. They had recruited me to travel to Palestine after seeing me speak about the conflict there for so many years, putting on human rights conferences at law schools. And I thought they were wild for recruiting me. I had spent time in southern Lebanon a year and a half under occupation by the Israeli Defense Force, and the odds were differently against me traveling in this manner. But I definitely thought it was time for me to see what it was I spoke about and what I studied about. So I decided to go, and here I am. We also had done this affinity training on how to make quick decisions in tricky situations. So I huddled the people together, and I said, we got to get the women and children home, back to their village. Everybody quickly said, yeah, that sounds like a great idea. And one guy that had recruited me the hardest and thought that there'd be some rom-com love story of him having me in his life and traveling to Palestine with a Middle Eastern woman. So he was kind of against it. He wasn't in charge and whatever. Democratically, I won. And this is a story about me creating a checkpoint in the land that they call Israel or Palestine. I quickly turned and found a woman of beauty and knew that I needed her help. And so I grabbed this woman with long red hair from Brooklyn and said, come with me. And she came with me. And as we walked over towards a soldier, I asked her to ask the soldier who made his breakfast. And she did. And he conveniently answered his truth, which was that his mother made his breakfast. It was easy to slip into a space of vulnerability and humanity with him. And in that conversation, he let us know that him and most of his friends pray each morning that they'll never have to use their gun. You see, in Israel, men and women are conscribed to 3 years of military service, and during that time, they must carry their artillery. It was an interesting fact. So he was ready to help negotiate something that was less than violent. So now we have lines of women and children on both sides of this file of soldiers, and they're checking paperwork, and well, I got my way, but I created a checkpoint. So the women and children got home, presuming something didn't happen to them on the way home. This was during the second intifada, or the second uprising, 25 years ago. One of the other things that I did on this trip was, and many of the volunteers, we held our passports outside of ambulances for the UPMRC or the Red Crescent or Red Cross in order for the ambulances to be able to get to the homes to help people. Turns out when you're locked in your home, a lot of babies are made or domestic violence happens. So we would protect the ambulances and make sure they could get back to the clinic to care for people with our American passports. It was something we were hoping would create safety. So I helped babies be born, essentially. And I look back on that experience. And I know in both situations where I created a checkpoint and helped babies get born, I had the best of intention. And there's a part of my life dedicated to studying impact over intention. In many ways, I think that maybe our actions are not responsible unless we know how it impacts ourselves, others, and the whole. But I know that those babies are 25 years old now and able to see themselves or their loved ones be blown up. I don't know what is right or what if I did was right. I do know what I saw. Thank you.
Gilnar Mansour. Gilnar is a person who creates spaces for all to be loved and heard in order to stop generational violence. Gilnar is the daughter of an immigrant. She is a survivor. Gilnar stands for love.
As we were working Gilnar's story, she shared with me more about what the experience was like for her, how she came to decide to go to Palestine, and some interactions with children there that stuck with her.
Asked my dad to go to Palestine. Well, when the Michigan peace team approached me about going to Palestine, I was like, you guys are crazy. You guys have a privilege that I don't have to travel in that way. But I've already been to the Middle East and I'm on list. When I travel in Lebanon, I've never taken citizenship there, but I've been offered it. But I do travel in Lebanon on a Lebanese ID card. And I have tried to cross into the country they call Israel from southern Lebanon. This is that bad neighborhood. So this causes concern. You get on a list when you try and cross that border.
Yeah.
And my folks tried a couple of times when I was a child to cross me over the border. I wasn't allowed either way. So finally, I convinced myself I wanted to go to Palestine to be able to be of witness to that which I speak about. And so I told my father that I was going. I asked his permission. He never said no. He never said yes. He never said no. So because he never said no, it was a yes for me. He said, I need to talk with them. And my father is very image-oriented. Mm-hmm. And so the woman who was going to be the base operations person in the U.S. for a trip, my father is not one to speak Arabic in front of non-Arabic speaking people, ever. And that day, for whatever reason, he decided to start to speak to me in Arabic very rudely. And so he said, what are you going to do for my daughter? And she said, well, we have these affinity trainings and, you know, we'll call a lawyer if we need to, if she gets somehow detained over there. And my dad's just rolling his eyes. Just, it's like the Peanuts mom talking to him. He's just like, whatever. And he looked at me and then looked at her and he said in English, there's nothing you're going to do for her. And then he looked at me and he said, Ibni Minajesha Salam. So he said, my daughter is a soldier of peace. She'll be helping you. That's when I received my yes to go. But he remained pretty firm that I knew what I was getting into more than they knew what they were putting me into. And I was never confused as a young person that I was going to go make change. but I think many people that I traveled with thought they were going to do something. I just wanted to witness what was going on. So I become a little bit differently versed. Just like in war, there's war theory, right? There's ways to go to war. These children pick up on these things, and they know their children. So I say, aren't you afraid of being shot? They said, anyone would hesitate to shoot a child, and by that time, I'm quick enough to be gone. That's what they banked on. Another child told me, he witnessed his best friend get shot and blown up. They picked up a ball. It had gunpowder in it. He touched his friend, and the sniper shot and it blew the kid up. And that kid wanted to be a freedom fighter.
Coming up after the break.
I take position on the left side of the doorway. My partner fills in the position of the right side of the doorway, and we fill this space. Naturally, our guns are drawn because we're searching this residence, and I yell, "Sir!"
On the sixth day, I got a phone call, and there were three kids on the other line, and they were calling from the Wolf Point pizza joint. I was like, "Hello?" They were like, all they said was, "We found your dog."
That's next on the Tell Us Something podcast. Remember that the next Tell Us Something event is October 7th. You can learn about how to pitch your story and get tickets at tellussomething.org. Thanks to our media sponsors, MissoulaEvents.net and Missoula Broadcasting Company. Learn more about Missoula Broadcasting Company and listen online at MissoulaBroadcastingCompany.com. Thanks to our in-kind sponsors, Float Missoula. Learn more at floatmsla.com and Joyce of Tile.
Hi, it's Joyce from Joyce of Tile. If you need tile work done, give me a shout. I specialize in custom tile installations. Learn more and see some examples of my work at joyceoftile.com.
Remember that the next Tell Us Something event is October 7th. You can learn about how to pitch your story and get tickets at tellussomething.org. All right, let's get back to the stories. You are listening to the Tell Us Something podcast. I'm Mark Moss. Opening up the second half of this episode of the Tell Us Something podcast, Steve Schmidt is a rookie police officer in Kansas City in 1997. Steve responds to a seemingly routine recovered property call that quickly escalates into a tense and dangerous encounter of a burglary in progress. What unfolds is a story of split-second decisions, unexpected revelations, and a profound moment that would forever shape his understanding of duty, perception, and the weight of a single choice. Steve calls his story, "Get Down on the Ground, Do It Now." Thanks for listening.
It was 1997, and I was driving my car in South Kansas City when my radio began to speak to me. 544 from Bannister and Hillcrest, go ahead. 544, respond to the area of 106th and Walrend on a reported recovered property call. Now, I was a very, very young police officer. In fact, 2 years prior to this call, I graduated from the Kansas City, Missouri Police Academy 9 days after turning 21 years old. I looked like I was about 15 and a half years old and that I was just wearing a really authentic looking police Halloween costume. So I respond to the area of 106 in Walrend, where I'm greeted by a family, and we go through the typical, "You don't look old enough to be a cop" thing. They hand me over a duffel bag that they had found at the edge of their property that they thought might have been involved with a purse snatching in the area. I look through the contents of this duffel bag, and one thing stands out, and that's an envelope with a name and address on it. So I check with dispatch, and I see if there's been any burglaries at that particular residence in the last 30 days or so. They said there hasn't been. So I said, "Hold me out at that address. Let me check with the homeowner." So I drive about 3 or 4 blocks away to this split-level home where the main living residence is all on one level and the bedrooms are above the garages. And I walk up to this house and I notice that the deadbolt is still in the locked position and the door frame is splintered in towards the inside of the residence, meaning the door has been kicked in and it's been recently burglarized. So I call for a second car because we're going to have to go inside and search this residence for any burglars that might be left inside. So I call for my second officer, and he shows up, and we do a procedure called holding the air, which means we have priority for any radio traffic on that particular frequency. In case there's an extreme emergency on the inside, all the other officers know that we're searching this house, and it's really important and pretty dangerous. So my officer partner shows up. We walk up to the front door, and we open the door, and we yell, "Police, is there anybody here?" And I don't hear any answer. We do a search of the main living area of the house, and I don't see any signs of burglary whatsoever. I'm quite confused. The fact that the VCR is still there, because back in 1997, VCRs were probably one of the most common things stolen from burglaries. We still have the upstairs to search, so I begin to make my way up the flight of stairs, and I see a bedroom on my right-hand side, I see a bedroom straight ahead, and I see another doorway on the left. I peek into the first room, and I see a suspect laying face down on the bed, sleeping. The first signs of burglary I see are directly behind this individual, where a dresser drawer is pulled out and sort of cockeyed a bit, and there's some clothes thrown about. I take position on the left side of the doorway. My partner fills in the position of the right side of the doorway, and we fill this space. Naturally, our guns are drawn because we're searching this residence, and I yell, "Sir!" He wakes up, gets up on his hands and knees, deer in the headlight look, looking at me. "Do you live here?" "Yes." I don't really like the way he answered that question, so I ask it again. "Do you live here?" "No." "Okay, we need you to get down off the bed now. Get down off the bed." He hops off the back side of the bed, and he's holding a T-shirt in his hand. And he starts to say, "I need to go outside. I need to go outside. I need to go outside." He walks to the end of the bed, and pretty much the width of a queen-size bed is all that separates us. And if you imagine a running back on the one-yard line with 1 second left in the fourth quarter, and they're given the ball trying to score that touchdown, this guy charges us. We both have our handguns out. I know that in order for him to reach out and grab my handgun, he has to drop this T-shirt first. As he hits us, both my partner and I holster up simultaneously, and we hit the back wall. We drop to the ground, and he starts pushing and kicking. "I need to go outside. I need to go outside." I'm on the radio. "Assist, assist, assist." And I have visions of Top Gun in my head going, "Eject, eject, eject," because all I want to do is get out of there. We fall down the flight of stairs. I'm on top of the suspect. The suspect's on top of my partner. We land at the base of the stairs, glasses breaking from a nearby coffee table. I'm trying to get this individual's hands behind his back, and I am just not strong enough. My little 15 and a half year old sized body just isn't going to do it. I let go of his left arm. I get a handcuff on his right arm, and I just yell, "Relax!" And he just magically goes limp, and I get the handcuffs on. I get on the radio, 544, we got one party in custody. The house is still hot. Keep the officers coming. Because when I yell assist, assist, assist on the radio, all the officers in the area drop everything they're doing, and they come rushing to our aid. I run back upstairs to search the other rooms that are upstairs, and this is where I see most of the evidence from the burglary. Nobody else is in the house. I clear the air. I go downstairs. I said, "We have one party in custody. Start me an ambulance," because this individual sustained a small cut on his arm from the fall. I begin to try to investigate who this guy is, and I'm asking him all these different questions, and he's not telling me his name in any way, shape, or form. And in fact, all he keeps saying to me is, "Put your socks on, put your socks on." And I'm like, "Thanks, man, I appreciate it." As he's sitting on the floor, I'm like, "Thanks, I appreciate it, I got my socks on." And I go, are you on drugs?" And he's like, "Yes." And I'm like, "Okay, that was probably one of the dumbest questions I've ever asked anybody. Like, I knew he was on drugs." And I wish I remembered the exact line of questioning I had for this individual, because one thing led to another as I was trying to figure out who he was. And I asked him, "What's your mom's name?" And he goes, "Teresa Williams." And I freeze. My partner looks at me and is like, what's wrong? I'm like, dude, Teresa Williams, that's the name that was on the envelope in the duffel bag four blocks away that brought me here. This guy lives here. And he's not on drugs. I don't know about you, but this is the closest I've ever come to shooting somebody. And my partner goes, if you would have shot, I would have shot. I go into the kitchen, I look through some paperwork, and I find some information about who his parents are. I get a hold of his dad, who's a principal of a local high school in Kansas City. And I call him and I say, there's been an incident here at the house. You need to come here. Your son's okay. We already had an ambulance for the son, and he was in the back of the ambulance being taken care of. Dad gets there, and I'm explaining everything that happened that led to me being in his house. And I'm to the point to where we were walking up the steps. I peeked inside, and I saw him sleeping in the bed. And I asked him, I was like, sir, do you live here? And he said, yes. And I said, I didn't like the way he said that. So I asked him again, sir, do you live here? And he said, no. And he goes, hold on a second. Let me tell you a little bit about my son. My son is 33 years old, and he has autism. He gets dropped off by a cab every single day. He has a garage door opener in his backpack, and he enters the house through the garage door. He goes into the kitchen, he makes himself a sandwich, and then he goes upstairs and lays down in one of the three bedrooms and goes to sleep until we get home. If you ask my son a yes-no question, he will always respond with yes. If you ask him that question again, he assumes the only reason why you're asking him that question a second time is he must have got the first one wrong, so he's going to answer no. So do you live here? Yes. Do you live here? No. And I'm thinking, how are we supposed to figure this out when I have a burglary suspect in front of me? Not pulling the trigger that day was the best decision I've ever made in my entire life. If I would have harmed that guy, I would not be here today. The headline in the newspaper across the country the next day would have been, two white officers shoot an unarmed autistic black man in his own home. And I would not have been able to live with that. It's been 28 years, and I think about this guy often. I have so much love for him and his family, and I hope life has been kind to him. And if he was here today, I would just want to say, I'm sorry I scared you.
Steve Schmidt, also known as Schmitty. Starting from his small-town origins in Malta, Montana, Schmitty is dedicated to positive change. With 8 years' experience as a police officer in Kansas City, Schmitty has developed strong skills in law enforcement and community engagement, all while connecting with thousands of fans as a professional mascot. Now based here in Missoula, Schmitty leads Drive Safe Missoula, a traffic safety initiative within Missoula Public Health that's focused on saving lives through education. His expertise extends nationally, where he speaks on influencing behavior and leveraging AI for road safety and public health.
Schmitty stopped by the Tell Us Something studios in the days following the event to share more about his story.
Hey, I'm Mark Moss. Thanks for listening to the Tell Something podcast. We just heard from Schmitty, his story he told on June 30th, 2025 at Ogren Park at Allegiance Field. And I caught up with Schmitty later after the fact. I'm here with him now in the Tell Something studios. Hey, Schmitty.
Hey, Mark. How are you? It's great to be here.
Thanks for coming and thanks for initiating this. You've said you wanted to fill in some gaps.
Yeah, you know, it was interesting going through the entire process of learning how to tell this story, which I think was so important during that process. Of course, when you get out there and you're in front of everybody and you're trying to stay to time, you forget a few things. And there were some key elements of my story that I would love to share with people, because I think people walked away with a few big question marks in their head about what the story really was all about.
Yeah.
And if you just listen to the story, one thing that I failed to mention in front of the group of people was that we believe this individual interrupted a burglary in progress. And speaking with his dad about his autism and all of that stuff, he didn't even have the ability to understand that he interrupted a burglary in progress. So when he arrived home using a garage door opener, he comes into the house and he goes into the kitchen. He makes himself a sandwich and then goes and lays down in one of the bedrooms upstairs and waits for his parents to get home. It's that when the garage opened is when we believe the actual burglars that were inside the house bolted out the front door, which is why so much of the house was left undisturbed, is they didn't have that much time to really go through everything. So it was a really interesting situation, of course, being there live and trying to put all this into place and then reflecting on it basically over the last 28 years of what that scene was really like and how scary it must have been for that guy, you know, with us being there yelling at him in his bedroom. And the fact that if those burglars that were in there, thankfully most burglars aren't out to really hurt people. They try to go into places when people aren't there. And thankfully they left, but thankfully they didn't do anything to harm this individual either. You know?
Yeah, and I was always so curious. You could have responded to that situation in so many different ways.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's the scary thing. You know, I think I may have mentioned, like, when we were falling down the stairs and I was putting the assist out on the radio and I was yelling, assist, assist, assist. You know, it was images of the Top Gun movie, eject, 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 that were going through my head because I was so scared at that moment. I mean, I wanted to get out of there. And it was weird how, like, looking back on it that evening, why my brain responded that way and how I had those images in my head as we are falling down the stairs and I'm on the radio yelling, assist, assist, thinking that there's still other people in the house who are going to come out of the house and be shooting at us as we are falling down the stairs, and trying to put all of that information together. It was just a really crazy moment.
Right, and you still didn't know.
Had no
that
idea.
He wasn't actually the perpetrator.
Right. We thought he was the burglary suspect, that for one reason or another, here he is in the house and he was acting very strange. So it made sense that if he was on drugs, maybe he stayed behind for one reason or another. Stranger things have happened. And of course, I'm not thinking at that moment when I see this individual laying on the bed that, okay, so if this is the burglar, then how did the duffel bag with the contents end up four blocks away? Like, you don't think about those questions in that moment.
Right.
But, you know, as things settled down and we were asking him questions and trying to figure out who he was, those things are the things that started to pop into my head, which ultimately led me to ask him, what's your mom's name? And then when he said his mom's name, you know, I just froze. I mean, I was just, you know, sick to my stomach automatically. I mean, this is the closest I've ever come to pulling the trigger on somebody. And thankfully, our training, the constant ongoing training that we have to deal with these situations, allowed me the ability at such a young age to make the right decision at that time to not pull the trigger, which I think was vitally important, you know?
Yeah, clearly. We never hear this story.
Yeah.
We always hear the story of the cop that made the wrong decision.
Right. That's what makes the news.
And how do we get more of this story? How do these cops who have made the wrong decision, or how the cops that haven't yet made the wrong decision because they haven't been placed in this circumstance?
Yeah.
How do we get them that kind of training? Or, you know, like, it just blows my mind, you know? And some of the listeners don't know that my dad was a cop, so I'm very familiar with police training and what's required and decision-making in tough circumstances. He was on the police force in cities about the size of Missoula in Ohio near Akron for 40 years as a detective and also out on the streets. And it's not easy work.
Right, right. It's not easy work in any way, shape, or form. And most of the issues that I have seen over the last several decades when it comes to police officers making the bad call, or, you know, really negative press related to police officers, I always chalk it up to, well, there was a failure in training that occurred that allowed this to occur the way it did. And so I wonder how departments really focus on analyze these situations internally to utilize the worst case scenarios or the worst case situations that are being broadcast maybe nationally. How do they utilize that as an opportunity to learn to make their departments better? And I was really impressed with the Kansas City, Missouri Police Department. Not that I had anything to ever compare it to, but I was impressed with how well they analyze situations from any use of force report to any sort of major interaction from citizen complaints. How do we utilize this to make our department better? And obviously, this was a long time ago when I was wearing the uniform and behind the badge, and it was before police officers had body cameras, and we were just starting to get video cameras in our cars, and it was still being recorded on VHS tapes. And it was interesting how many officers were upset with the fact that they're going to be on tape, because they would think that, oh, well, this is just going to be utilized to punish me when I do things wrong. And I always had that concept of, you know what, I'm super excited that this is being recorded, because one, I want my supervisors to be able to see all the good that I'm doing, because just like the news doesn't see it, my supervisors didn't get to see it because they weren't on every single call with me, right? They might be on one call a week with me, and I have 28 calls a day that I was going on. So this will be an opportunity that they would be able to see the good work that I'm doing and utilize that maybe as a training opportunity for other young officers coming up. But I was really excited about the fact that if I ever made a mistake, that it could be recorded, and not only myself, but every other officer had an opportunity to learn from it, because we learn most from our mistakes. And I would have a new recruit sitting next to me in the car, and I'd be like, hey, what did we learn most from? We learn most from our mistakes. Well, then let's go mess some stuff up. As long as it doesn't result in a, you know, $100,000 lawsuit and nobody gets injured or killed tonight, then let's go say the wrong thing, you know, not intentionally, of course, but let's appreciate the fact that we said the wrong thing to the wrong person at the wrong time, and now we learn from that, and now we're going to have a 30-year career where we'll never make that same mistake again. So yeah, let's mess it up now, learn the most we possibly can, and make ourselves better, and then let's share those lessons with everybody else so you don't have to drive down the same exact road that I drove down to learn these hard lessons, you know? And so that was the culture that was built into our environment in Kansas City that I was so impressed with, is that everybody said, hey, look, we're all learning and we're all going to make mistakes. Let's go. And it was great.
Closing out this episode of the Tell Us Something podcast, what begins as an unlikely friendship for Lauren Tobias with a free-spirited dog on the Fort Peck Indian Reservation in northwestern Montana takes a heartbreaking turn when the dog mysteriously disappears. Days of agonizing searching lead to a devastating discovery, a poignant makeshift funeral, and an outpouring of community support. Just as grief settles in, a shocking revelation sends everything spiraling into an unbelievable twist. Lauren calls her story Off Leash. Thanks for listening.
I never thought I'd have a dog. It's not that I don't love dogs, obviously. It's that I just like the guilt of, anyone who's a dog owner knows, the guilt of just like watching them stare at you in your house. It was just like too much for me. So when I moved to the Fort Peck Reservation in late 2018, my perspective on dog relationship kind of got blown out of the water. Anyone who maybe in the who's listening in the audience might know, the relationship that people have with dogs there is just very symbiotic, and people consider them members of the community. It, from the outside, it might look like they are just like don't have homes, but actually like people take care of them, and they're meaningful parts of the community. And so when I met many dogs while I was living there, I spent about 4 years, and This one particular dog stood out to me. She was a big, poofy, white, fluffy dog, and she had a slap happy personality. I would see her on the streets with like this pack, this like miscellaneous pack of dogs, and every time she saw me, she would like jump on me and like greet me, and we had this like developing relationship over the course of months. And she would do this thing where I swear she like knew that she could make people laugh, direct eye contact, and like a foot long tongue just like hanging out of her mouth. And she would like dip her shoulder, butt would just flop down to the floor like a seal's tail. And then she would just like get on her belly, ask for belly rubs. And she would just like still be making eye contact with you. And so that's how I like met her. And eventually she kind of started following me like in town, and we sort of developed a courtship. And after a couple months, decided to make it official, which meant that I got her vaccinated and slapped a collar on her. And a week later, she told me that she was pregnant. And I was not the father. And so that was our first experience together. So my whole thing about the guilt and the dogs, we had this very fluid relationship, and we never went there, just for the record. So we had this like come and go. She would just sort of like sit on my porch all day, and she would kind of like knock on the door. She wanted to come in the house. She'd knock on the door. She wanted to leave. She'd wander around all day. So it was kind of perfect. Like, we just developed trust, and then through like the raising of her babies, like, we developed even more of like this really natural, beautiful trust. And she was like my best friend. It sounds really cliche, but it was true. Everyone in town that knew me knew that she was my dog. And so, yeah, we spent probably about a year that she was kind of like with me. And so because of the nature of our relationship, when she didn't show up home one night, I didn't really think very much of it. And then two nights went by, and I was like, you know, she's done this before. You know, it's probably no big deal. Four nights go by, and I'm like, okay, like, I let her out of the house with a collar, without a collar on, because I, like, didn't always put a collar on her when she was leaving the house, because we would just kind of come in and out. And so I was like, she probably got lost. And I hung up posters all over Wolf Point. Those of you who know Wolf Point probably, like, didn't take that long to cover the town. It's pretty small town, but on the sixth day, I got a phone call, and it was from, there were three kids on the other line, and they were calling from the Wolf Point pizza joint, like the dial phone there. And they were like, I was like, hello? They were like, all they said was, we found your dog. And I was like, oh my God, like, where can I come get her? Like, yes, thank you so much. Like, I'll be right there. And I was just met with silence on the other line. And this was like literally the first time throughout the entire 6 days where I was like maybe something's wrong. Like, maybe something happened to her. I never considered it. She grew up around cars, and she was always really good around, you know, cars and stuff. So I never thought that that was like a possibility. So I run across town. I drive across town. I pick them up, and I'd ask them to show me where she was. And when we start walking up to the train tracks, I was like, oh my God, like, no way. So I walk up and I see her body deflated and lifeless and just like formed to the rails of the track. And yeah, sorry, that was really graphic. So the kids are still with me. And they're like, this is the most interesting thing that's happened to us all day. We just located your dead dog off of a missing poster sign, so we're like here for this. And I was like, can you please leave me for a second? And so they did, and they left me for like, you know, 10 minutes. And then I saw them circling back, and I was like, okay, I think we're in this. And I'm like, okay, if I'm remembering myself as a child, and I had done that, like, sleuthing. Like, I'd probably be pretty invested, too. So I was like, all right, you can come with me. And they were like, what are you going to do? I'm like, I don't know. Do you have any ideas? Never been in this situation before. So they came with me. I went back to my house. I grabbed a bathrobe, went back to the train tracks. I wrapped her up, 65 pounds, picked her up, put her in my trunk. Did the only thing I could think to, you know, thank the kids. Went to the McDonald's drive-thru. Dog's still in the back of my trunk. And then I took them home, and I go home, and now I'm, like, alone for the first time, making phone calls. And I'm getting text messages from people I didn't even tell, sending their condolences. And I made an appointment the next morning with the Wolf Point Crematorium. They said they'd make an exception and cremate a dog the next day. So my friends who lived downstairs, three friends came upstairs. They were devastated because they, like, loved her, too. They knew her spirit. And we had, like, probably the most beautiful funeral and ceremony that I've ever been to. We took her body out of the trunk. We put it on her bed outside in, like, this kind of mud room. And we put her toys around her, her treats, sweetgrass sage. They kind of burned sage, and we were drinking whiskey, laughing, crying. And there was, like, also this moment I wanted to stamp her paw print. I was like, which arm am I going to get tattooed? I wanted to stamp her paw print on something, like, sentimental. The closest thing I could find was my ukulele. I can't get into that side quest right now, but basically it was, like, some pube trimmers, a nail polish, navy blue nail polish, and my friend's CSI knowledge about, like, rolling it, which, like, was not intuitive at all. It was, like, a mess. But it gave us, like, the first belly laugh of like, the 24 hours. And so I went to bed, got a really terrible night's sleep. And I wake up the next morning. I'm flipping pancakes. I'm still crying. And it's the first thing I've eaten since the McDonald's the day before at, like, 3 p.m. And I get a text message on my phone, and I see a picture. Someone forwards me a Facebook post, and I see a picture of my dog. I know I've lost credibility of saying this, but it was her, the picture. I'm like, why is someone sending me this? I look at the caption, and it says, anyone know whose sweet dog this is? Like, she showed up on my porch today. I look at the timestamp, it was yesterday, so I'm like, maybe it's an old picture, I don't know. And so I message her, find her address, and then my friend Mush from the night before the funeral comes banging on my door and is like, have you seen this? Text message, like, she just got it forwarded to you. And so I'm like, shut the fuck up. Like, I don't know. Like, please don't get my hopes up. We're like, we drive. So I'd, like, make her get in the car with me. We drive 6 miles to get to this person's house. And we open the door. Out comes running my actual dog. This is Fluffer. She's 7 years old now, and we're a pet therapy team. yeah, and so she, nothing happened. She was just pumped. She was like, wow, haven't seen you in a week. Like, what's up? Like, I've been through a lot. Like, whew. She didn't, like, look like she lost weight, because she just, you know, she's chilling. She probably made some friends. So anyway, the denouement of this story is that I still have the dog in my closet, you know? yeah. So the appointment to get her cremated was, like, in an hour. And so I did the best thing I could do. I took real Fluffer. In the broad daylight, it was April, so the ground was really hard. I tried, I promise, I did my best. I know this is not environmentally friendly, but I, like, took the bathrobe, the dog, dug a shallow grave in the hills of Wolf Point. And, yeah, that was it. And then I invited the kids to come on an adventure with Fluffy and I. And they got to meet her and hear the things I was telling about. And yeah, now we're just living life. And that's my story of lost and found. So thank you.
Closing out our evening tonight is Lauren Tobias. When Lauren moved to Montana from the suburbs of New York City 9 years ago in search of some peace and quiet, she never could have expected she'd be making home here. She loved visiting the many nooks and crannies of Montana via highways, gravel tire track roads, hiking trails, bike paths, and her favorite, an 8-seater plane. During her time here, she's been called to infinitely learn, from how to recognize what's under the hood of her car, to self-expression through photography, to embracing a queer identity, to picking up beer league ice hockey in her 30s. Those last two things are related only by pure coincidence, she assures me. Lauren has found more life here than she could have ever imagined. She spent COVID living on the Fort Peck Indian Reservation, learning a more holistic history of our country and about the incredible culture and decolonization efforts of indigenous nations.
You are listening to the Tell Us Something podcast. I'm Mark Moss. Remember that the next Tell Us Something event is October 7th. You can learn about how to pitch your story and get tickets at tellussomething.org. You can find us on Instagram, Facebook, YouTube, and Blue Sky, and visit tellussomething.org to explore 14 years of our story archives. And let me know what you thought of the new format. You can email me at info@tellussomething.org to share your thoughts.